Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Because I think we're all searching.
There are some people that think that the media would
bias.
It's Wednesday, January 18th, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Thanks for joining us this week. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Panelists and journalism school colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis are in their regular spots, ready to opine on the performance of the news media. This week, we're discussing the power of words and pictures and the efforts by some to censor or control them. Well, obviously, that's a very broad topic, so we're going to focus our attention on these items today: the blackout by Wikipedia and others to protest anti-piracy laws that are being debated in Congress, the latest newspaper to pull a cartoon for fear of offending readers, the pushback over Newsweek's latest magazine cover that asks, "Why are Obama's critics so dumb?" and an episode of The Simpsons that skewers cable TV talk show hosts who dumb down our political speech. Let's start with two pieces of legislation that have drawn widespread protest on the internet this week: the Stop Online Piracy Act and the Protect Intellectual Property Act. Wikipedia is the most well-known of several websites that are blacking out content today. They're claiming essentially that's what would happen if these two bills pass. Wikipedia's entire English language version is unavailable today. As you can see by this graphic, for those of you who are watching it online, it shows you not only that they're blacking out the day, but directing you to reasons for why Wikipedia is doing that. Well, there is a trick around that, in fact. You can press the escape key while you're loading your favorite Wikipedia entry, and it will pop up, even if it's the English language version. Well, Charles, proponents of this legislation are saying that the intent is to make it harder for foreign companies to steal copyrighted music and movies and TV shows and the like, and then offer them illegally for downloading or for streaming. They say that they would do this by putting the onus on the search engines like Google and Yahoo and others to block links to those sites, and also to block or to put the onus on financial services companies like PayPal and Visa and such to stop them from processing payments for these folks. Now, on the face of it, that sounds pretty reasonable. So why isn't it?
It also puts the onus on content providers and content generators, aggregators, new sites, and everyone else. This is the bluntest instrument imaginable. If you were going to go after piracy, I can't imagine a legislative solution that is more dull-edged and overbroad. And if you look up narrowly tailored in your constitutional textbook, this would be the opposite of that in every way. So the response online and offline to this has been overwhelming and dramatic. And I read, in fact, minutes before coming down here, that it looks like the Senate is now caving in real time around SOPA as well. What you've got here is two pieces of legislation, one in the House, one in the Senate. Everybody thought it had broader support in the Senate, maybe because they're smaller numbers and fatter cats getting the ears of them. But now they apparently are feeling the thunder of this internet protest, which is amazing in its scope and its breadth.
Well, you could imagine why early on some folks might have thought it had a better chance than it does, because you had some big hitters, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a lot of the major media companies, the corporations were behind it. So you would expect those folks, they have a lot of money, they lobby very hard in Congress, that they would get their way. So what did happen, and why is this internet protest, you know, which, there have been internet protests all the time, why is this particular one resonating with lawmakers?
Well, I've wondered about that, and I've wondered how net neutrality, for example, came to become an ideological partisan issue where Democrats are for it, Republicans are against it. And this one, which in many ways pits some of the exact same issues: who's going to control the internet, big corporations or individuals? Are we going to continue to embrace the values of openness and transparency and egalitarian access that undergird the internet? Or are we going to cede it to the Motion Picture Academy of America? Many of these issues are similar, so I've been trying to figure out the difference. And the only one I can get to is the fact that the rather than just scream about it, opponents of SOPA have been very strategic in disseminating really hardcore factual information about just what's in the bill. And I think the devil being in the details, this bill is it's really, really bad. I mean, as a person who values free speech, it's hard for me to articulate just how offensive it is. It would allow any corporate holder of something to go get a court order to not just remove the pirated content from, but shut down a website, any website on the internet that has the content on it. And I think that's what got everybody up in arms.
Lee, I mean, I suppose we should point out that, although I think Charles' analysis of who's behind it and who's against it is pretty clear, there are some pretty heavy hitters who are against this legislation too. I mean, Google's a pretty heavy hitter, you know, and all of the Silicon Valley companies that are worried about this are really heavy hitters. Still, do you share his general assessment of what this law would intentionally or otherwise do if it were passed?
I share his general and in some ways very specific assessment of what the law would do. And I want to go back to something that Charles said, because I think it is a very blunt instrument that for our profession doesn't get at what I view as the most serious problem, which is how do you pay for the creation of news? Where does that bill come home to roost, if you will, and how do you pay for subsequent uses of something that was not free to generate in the first place? I also think it allows us on this show and us in the classroom, at least, to ask our students and everybody else, you know, what's the difference between information and meaning? Is all content meaningful? And certainly, while I think that there's a lot of money involved here, I do think that in some political hands, I can see where we were now, in addition to deleting websites that mention certain things. We'll also delete websites that mention, oh, let's see, the morning after pill, ways that you can get certain sorts of services, if you will, things that are critical of government, ours or someone else's. I mean, there are a lot of sort of potential political machinations in this one, that the devil isn't just in the detail. I think the devil is in the mischief that you can get up to pretty quickly.
Before we get into some of the specifics about the media's interest in this bill, I want to ask about a sort of a broader issue that's kind of been raised in the discussions today. And this notion is one journalism professor said that it's all about the culture and the soul of the internet. He said, the guy's name is Mark Tatke, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. He says, is the internet a venue where people share and express ideas and is open and collaborative, or is it something that is controlled by corporations who decide what people should be able to view because it will bring them profits? Is it really that black and white, Charles?
No. But we like to soar to the rhetoric, particularly when we're talking about the internet. It lends itself to that kind of lofty rhetoric. But the bottom line is there is such a thing as piracy. There is such a thing as copyright. There will continue to be both of those terms. The industry, be it the motion picture industry or the U.S. Chamber of Commerce or the RIAA, all these groups that are in favor of doing something about this, started from the right position, which is we need to do something about this. It's what they've done that leaves me aghast, which is, I mean, the devil's in the details, right? And ultimately what we have here is a really sophisticated collaborative effort between some of the world's largest corporations and one of the world's largest government to enforce through court order shutdown notices for anybody who has pirated content on their site, regardless of A, how it got there, B, whether or not it was pirated. And that's not always an open and shut case, particularly in a sharing environment. That's not always that easy to determine. Beyond that, I think what Lee hinted at, I think I could take a step further. The fact that we are in the journalism business, people that are talking about governments and rulers and repressive regimes around the world would see something like this, I think, and go, yeah, it's another day in the neighborhood. The fact that we're doing it against the First Amendment to the United States Constitution is laughable, because it's a non-starter to create a regime in which the offending company can go to government and go, we'd like to just take down their site.
Let's talk a little bit about how different media organizations and individuals have been responding to this protest and this legislation, Lee. The Wall Street Journal's take on it, and their editorials at least, not their news coverage, was also pretty cut and dried. I mean, here's what they had to say. The evangelists seem to believe that anybody is entitled to access any content at any time at no cost. Their real ideological objection is to the concept of copyright itself. Now, again, they're painting in black and white, but there really is something to this notion of a sort of different cultures. This internet culture versus an older corporate culture, or just even an older culture that did value copyright over some other things like collaboration and sharing. Isn't that a sort of a fair dichotomy to point out?
I think it's one dichotomy. I don't think it's the only one. And I think that's one of the things that makes this issue so interesting is there not two sides. There's probably 87 of them if you can do that. I think part of the confusion is what copyright is about. Copyright is about permission to copy. That is what the law of copyright is all about. It always has been. There, we say you can't copyright an idea, but many of us actually, when we take that idea and we put it in our precious words, that's what we want to copyright. We want to copyright the fact that, you know, that somebody wrote the electric Kool-Aid acid test and that phrase is his forever and ever and ever. But that's not really what the law of copyright is all about. And so I think one of the things we've got going on here is a law that was, or a set of laws, as Charles would remind me, that essentially started in the 19th century, had no conception of what it meant to be digital. And now we're dragging it kicking and screaming into a digital age without sort of clarifying what the underlying concepts really are all about. And it's no wonder we're having trouble.
Well, and the Wall Street Journal editorial board has never let the facts get in the way of a good opinion. I mean, no one in the opposition to SOPA is saying, and they take great pains to say, we're not opposed to copyright as a doctrine. We're not opposed to anti-piracy laws as they exist. It's the nature of this one that is so vile. And they're, I mean, I think they're right. But I understand. I mean, both of these parties, whether it's Professor Tateke or the Wall Street Journal editorial page, they've got to speak in these sort of absolutes. But this isn't a dichotomous either-or situation.
Well, if anybody ever thought that there was a sort of one homogenous media with their response to this law, that's certainly not true, because you've got these news organizations, companies, corporations that run news organizations are largely in favor of this bill or some compromise along those lines. And you have organizations that represent news professionals like the Online News Association or the National Association of News Editors, and they are completely against it. Mm-hmm. In fact, you even have today, Lee, the Washington Post and ABC News and NPR and some others are actually out there, and maybe it's marketing as much as anything, but they're running a Twitter hashtag for people to ask questions who can't get to Wikipedia because they say they believe so much in the value of being able to share information.
Well, and there's sharing information, and that's one kind of a culture. But, you know, you asked what is the kind of culture of the internet, and Charles says it's both. I think if you look at the sum total of the activity that takes place on the internet, it's commercial, it's capitalized, it's a mall. The information part of what goes on there, let alone the construction of meaning part, is a very small sliver of what's happening on the internet right now.
I do think too, Charles, it's kind of interesting or ironic to me that just a few years ago, news professionals and the organizations that employed them were all about shutting down free aggregation of content. And now they're using that as an argument that this legislation could somehow slow or halt the free aggregation of content on their websites as a reason to be against
it. We've come full circle on that argument, haven't we? The journalism businesses, at least at the granular level where we're doing the journalism, I think have come 180 degrees on the issue of content. Now it's we want people to share and engage with our content in as many places as is humanly possible. I can see where the motion picture industry is not going to get to that point because it's a little bit different form of content.
Another journalism professor used to work at CNN, Rebecca McKinnon, has had some positions in Asia teaching at Chinese universities, has said that she thinks that it's also ironic that the mechanism that Congress is talking about using, the technical mechanism for carrying out this legislation, is eerily similar, if not, as she puts it, almost identical to the mechanism the Chinese government or the Iranian government is using to censor the internet.
Well, censorship is censorship. I mean, that's the whole thing. Censorship is not a Chinese concept or an American concept. It's a concept that transcends periods in history and certainly governments. And I think it's one of the problems of looking at this as a technical or technological fix, as opposed to actually trying to sort out what your first principles are and then building a technology and a legal system that will support that. And that would actually require, I think at least, for us to go pitch our existing copyright law completely out the window and start again with a law that makes sense given the environment we're currently in.
Charles, speaking of China and the crackdown on dissent, there is one little sliver of the Wall Street Journal editorial that I kind of sympathize with, maybe not the ultimate conclusion, but a point that they make in support. And that's that it's really interesting that companies like, you know, well, like Wikipedia is actually a nonprofit organization, but Google and others are out there, you know, waving the flag today with all their blackouts and protests. Why don't they express a similar level of outrage toward the folks like the governments of China and Iran and elsewhere who are really censoring people's rights to speak?
Sure. Well, and Google's leaned on China pretty hard in terms of internet rights, right? I mean, they've lost that battle for the most part, but they fought it at least. Of course, the big difference is that they don't have a First Amendment. We do. They don't have a long tradition of protecting almost absolutely expression. We do. And so to enact what looks like, as Rebecca McKinnon said, an Iranian-Chinese regulatory regime in the American system is just abhorrent. And so, I mean, it's a bit of a straw man argument. Why aren't you fighting this fight in China? Well, it's a little different fight in China. Here, of course, we were facing a vote on the House version of this bill next week. Right. And it right. And it was expected to pass fairly overwhelmingly until today.
There's one other aspect, Charles, of the bill that I wasn't familiar with, or at least one critique of the bill that I was not familiar with. But a First Amendment lawyer quoted in one of the articles on our blog says there's also this concern specifically for journalists and others who want to use encryption technology on the Internet to communicate with anonymous sources like whistleblowers or political dissidents, and that this law might somehow make that more difficult.
Yeah, it probably will. I mean, clearly in the surveillance and detection side of it, they were going to enact this incredible system, which really probably would have allowed anybody in government to potentially interfere with just about any speech that somebody made an argument had some pirated content attached to it. And again, I've read also people saying that until the investigation and inquiry was complete and you determined whether there was pirated content there, the site would be shut down in the meantime. So anytime you wanted to shut someone up, you could go, they have pirated content, government comes running over. I mean, I don't know if it'd get this draconian, but potentially. And it's really the really sensitive stuff that you most worry about.
Lee, let's switch over to another story that's about self-censorship, and this involves, most recently, a story from last Friday. The Cleveland Plain Dealer newspaper, and on its website, decided not to publish a cartoon that they typically publish. It was that day's episode of Non Sequitur, which is written by Wiley Miller, one of the really great comics. It's actually in the papers these days. The cartoon in question showed a bunny rabbit. The bunny rabbit's looking at a police lineup of several different animals. You can see it on the video if you're watching our show that way. And the rabbit says, they all really do look alike to me. Well, the paper said that the strip was, quote, deemed objectionable. I noticed the passive voice there. Didn't say that who deemed it objectionable. I guess they did. Why would that cartoon be so objectionable that that newspaper, and by the way, they're the only one, decided to pull it that day?
Because they had their sense of humor excised? I mean, I don't know. It's one of the really interesting academic as well as just human nature questions is about why is it that something hits your funny bone and doesn't hit mine, but we're looking at the same image and thinking the same thing. I suspect, considering everything else, that whether or not it was meant to be this way, the Plain Dealer was worried about one of two things. A, race, okay, which we have terrible trouble with in this country, and the discussions in South Carolina and the presidential contests are yet another current illustration of that. Or B, terrorism, or goodness knows, in that cartoon, they could have both gotten confabulated together in some really interesting ways.
You know, it used to be, Charles, that and newspapers don't do this regularly, and so when they come up, it really does make news. But it used to be that Doonesbury was the cartoon that was most likely to be pulled by one newspaper newspaper or another. Now, lately, it has been non sequitur. They seem to be the new target. For example, last month, there were some papers, not a large number of them, but some papers who pulled another one of his strips, which we're going to show you, has a doctor at an office that's labeled Personal Crisis Center. He's looking at his next patient, who's a Klansman, and he's holding a sign that says Kane for President. The doctor tells his secretary, better hold the calls for the rest of the day. And then about 15 months ago, there was another one of these, and this time several newspapers, including the Washington Post, who censored it. And this was a cartoon from non sequitur. It starts with a takeoff. The image itself is a takeoff on Where's Waldo, the popular kids' books. At the top, above the image, it reads, picture book title voted least likely to ever find a publisher. And then below it, it reads, Where's Muhammad? And several papers, including the Washington Post, as I said, pulled that cartoon, arguing that it might offend their readers, especially Muslim readers. We've heard that argument before around the Jyllands Postens cartoons of Muhammad in Denmark. Why, though, would newspapers feel in the United States now, this the state of debate we're having about these political issues, that whether it's a Klansman holding a picture, a sign that says, you know, vote for Kane, or that, why would we have to pull that? Why wouldn't that cartoon generate a debate that we really ought to be having?
Ah, you radio listeners, I'm shaking my head furiously from side to side because I just don't know, beyond an abundant lack of common sense, a sense of humor, a backbone. Any sense that you serve the public by furthering debate and commentary, not by stifling it, that we are defenders of free expression and free speech and not apologizers for it. I mean, the whole sequence of those cartoons just infuriates me that we have such mealy-mouthed management that would sit around and work themselves in knots over something like the police lineup cartoon. It's ridiculous. I mean, first of all, since black and white grainy TV detective movies, people have been walking out of police lineup room going, they all look alike to me. And it had nothing to do with race, gender, ethnic background, or religion. It had to do with the fact that they were all mugs, right? Everybody looked like they had these like stereotypical criminal right. types in there. I don't know. I mean, I think we've just been oversensitized.
But even when there is race, and I mean, the Herman Cain one is showing the tension between, you know, a Klansman voting for an African-American Republican candidate, and there's clearly religion involved in the Muhammad cartoon. But have we really not learned anything from that whole Jyllands Postens problem 4 or 5 years ago, whatever it was?
Well, if we've not learned anything, I don't know. I mean, there's a couple of things. Maybe we've learned that the best way to avoid controversy is simply to try to get rid of it, which of course generates its own controversy. The thing that mystifies me about this, especially that middle cartoon, is to me it's a commentary on look how complex people are. Look how complicated our politics have become. Why would you not want to have that in the newspaper? Is that not what the newspaper is for?
I have to say, by the way, I'm going to hand out a special double standard award on this today to the Poynter Institute, which normally brings a lot of these issues to our attention and, in fact, brought this one to mind. But when we talked about the three cartoons in the past 15 months that have been censored, there are links in the Poynter article to the first two, the Bunny Rabbit cartoon, right? There's a link to that one. There's a link to the Kane cartoon. There is no link to the cartoon about Where's Muhammad. I just find that reprehensible. Now, there has been a long history, Charles, to sort of killing objectionable cartoons. This is by far not the first time. I mean, Art Buchwald, who was a legendary columnist, said back in the 70s that dictators of the right and the left fear the political cartoonist more than they fear the atom bomb. Still true? And is it true of the media as well?
I don't think the political leaders fear it as much as the editors do now. They must live in total fear of it because they'll have to make a decision to support freedom of speech over objectionable email and letters. And I don't know if it's easier now for critics, particularly astroturfing organized critics, to bombard editors and ombuds people with complaints about something like that. So there's all this manufactured outrage around these things. And I think management tends to overreact because there is such a volume. I mean, it's loud. And I don't think it's easy to shut that kind of stuff off, but I think you've got to.
Well, as we've clearly been saying today, it's no secret to anyone in the news media that pictures and words can inspire us, they can anger us, and of course, they can draw an audience that will help to pay the bills. Lee, and I'm wondering about another example of that from Newsweek. This week, they did it again. On their cover, there's this determined-looking picture of President Obama, and the headline reads, "Why Are Obama's Critics So Dumb?" Now, some of those critics, especially a lot of conservative bloggers and columnists, have not taken that very well, and they've written some, you know, nasty grams back at Newsweek. But isn't this really just another one of those savvy business decisions on the part of Newsweek, which is, you know, almost had to pull itself out of, you know, non-existence to try to bring in a sympathetic audience?
I think this is called free media. We create a controversial cover, and Newsweek has done this a whole lot in the past 6 months. It gets covered as a news story, thereby advertising my magazine without having to pay anything for it. And at least Newsweek and its corporate owners at that point are going to win.
I'm not sure, Charles, that Newsweek per se has that big an impact on the political debate today. So why are sort of the conservative bloggers getting all upset because Andrew Sullivan writes something like, "Given the enormity of what he inherited and given what he explicitly promised, it remains a simple fact that Obama has delivered in a way that the unhinged right and purist left have yet to understand." Why are they getting so upset about that particular cover?
And notice that sentence included the right and the left. I don't think the right heard that second half of the conjunctive clause there. I don't know. I mean, you're right. My first thought was Newsweek? That still exists? It's sort of like, I don't know, reading a column in Grit magazine and getting really upset about it. I didn't even know it was still there. That having been said, shrewd strategy of Newsweek, first of all, throw the inflammatory headline on there. But the other thing they did that I don't think people noticed was Sullivan first popped that thing on the net, and it went around Facebook like crazy for about a week before it ever appeared in Newsweek. And in fact, the Newsweek thing has almost become an afterthought to the stuff that they're throwing at the Daily Beast first, which is pretty clever.
I guess another lesson, if there was a lesson from anything we've talked about today, is that sometimes humor can be a better way to convey your message than vitriol. Yeah. Because one of the ways on one of the expressions of concern from the right that I found actually most effective was from Caleb Howe over at the Red State blog. And instead of just going on and on and on about how terrible Newsweek was, and how liberal their bias is, he instead decided to conduct a photoshopping contest where he had his readers send in, you know, parodies of this cover. There's got one with President Obama, and instead the headline reads, "Vows to turn this economy around 360 degrees. Think about that for a second. That's kind of interesting. Another one has Joe Biden on the cover eating a hot dog, I guess, with the headline saying, "How Joe Biden will solve the European debt crisis." So we'll have to think about those, and if you want to see more of those covers, they're on our blog. Well, we're going to have to leave it there this week with one more provocative image. This one is courtesy of The Simpsons. On a recent episode, Homer decides to channel his frustrations into a new job as a cable TV host. He calls his show Gut Check, and he includes a monologue where he uses a giant steak in the shape of the United States.
"Y'all know I'm a big fan of American meat. Although sometimes you gotta cut off some of the gristle."
And he's cutting off California and New York.
"Take that, centers of art and commerce! And this country has something extra that makes our meat the juiciest, most melt-in-your-mouth, stay-in-your-heart meat in the world. That's right. I'm talking about the gravy of freedom. When March Madness spills into April, that's the gravy. When someone messes with you and you invade the country that did it, plus another one, that's the gravy. When you stick your flag in the moon and say, 'Now we're done trying,' that's the gravy. So get on the boat. The gravy boat. Good night. And good gravy."
And soon Homer is leading a political movement with average Americans wearing gravy boats on their heads. He uses his newfound fame to endorse Ted Nugent, of all people, the rock guitar icon, right-wing commentator, and avid sportsman for President of the United States. You can see the full episode via Hulu on our Views of the News blog. We also have links to the Newsweek magazine cover and those non-sequitur cartoons we mentioned. There's also a quick and easy way for you to leave your comments. You can just visit KBIA.org, click on the Talk Show tab. You can also send us questions, comments, or suggestions via email, views@KBIA.org. Thanks to our technical team, Travis McMillan and Raymond Tungekar. I'm Mike McKean. Charles and I will be back, and the host will be sitting in for Lee next week for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.